The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. In a few minutes, we're going to meet our guests for the first hour, Brad Huebner from Environment Maryland and John Thompson from the Clean Air Task Force, as we talk about coal and whether coal is a clean air technology or not. Can it ever be? We'll talk about that this hour. But first, we got to see what's happening on the roads and tell you that Nationwide Insurance, offering accident forgiveness at Nationwide Insurance, is at 1-877-NATIONWIDE. Now for the traffic.
And they talk about clean coal technology so much.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. This first hour, we're going to take a look at clean coal technology. There's a lot of argument about that in this country. Can it exist? Is there such a thing as clean coal? Some people argue that's exactly what we have to have in America, because half of all the energy in this country comes from clean coal, as is half of all the nitrogen oxide emissions, and more. And the coal slides you see throughout Appalachia, they also come with coal. But can that change is the question we're going to wrestle with. President Barack Obama seems to have faith in it. He has put $3.4 billion in the federal stimulus package for carbon capture and sequestration, which is the technology we'll be talking about that has to do with clean coal. The others saying, no matter what you do, it's a dangerous way to go, and that we should be using renewables and putting that kind of money in other places other than coal. We'd love to hear what you think at 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation we're about to have with Brad Huebner. And Brad is the State Director of Environment Maryland. Good to have you back, Brad, as always. And joining us for the first time is John Thompson. Joins us by phone. He is Director of the Coal Transition Project at the Clean Air Task Force. And John Thompson, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And y'all can join us at 410-319-8888. I want to play a little clip for you first. We've talked about coal a great deal on this program over the last couple of years. Earlier last year, we sent our producer, Justin Levy, down to West Virginia to go to the coal fields and do a series of stories and play you one small clip from Ed Wiley to set the tone. He's a former coal miner. He's president of the Coal River Valley, West Virginia. He's not a proponent of clean coal, but let's see what Ed Wiley has to say, and we'll dive into this conversation.
And they talk about clean coal technology so much. People need to understand what they're doing with the toxic waste. If you're cleaning it, what are you doing with the waste? And what they're doing with the waste, they're putting it in our backyards, damming up these haulers. You know, billions of gallons of it backed up in the middle of a stream. Millions of gallons of it being pumped into the water. And like I said earlier, it's happening to our children. It's happening in our backyards now. But it's most important that America needs to know this is their backyard, because this is where their water comes from. And I feel that it's very important that the American people need to know there is no such thing as clean coal technology. They can clean it all they want to burn it better in the power plants, but what are they doing with the waste?
That was Ed Wiley, a former coal miner from West Virginia, talking about his thoughts on clean coal, but from the other end, from the end of mining the coal in the first place, and what that does. And the reality is, we'll talk about it during the course of the hour as well, is that we saw hundreds of acres in Roane County, eastern Tennessee, buried under billions of gallons of toxic coal sludge just recently. Coal combustion in this country produces 130 million tons of coal ash every year, and it's left to the states to figure out in their 600 landfills how to handle that, not the federal government. But then on the other side, people are saying, look, in America, coal makes up 50% of the energy this country uses. We better find a way to use it in a clean way, or we're going to be out of luck because renewables won't do it, and it will take too long for nuclear power to come online if you agree with that kind of power. So what do you think at 410-319-8888? So first, let's talk about the political, the what we both think here of the possibility that coal could actually be clean. And John Thompson, I'd like to start with you and let you kind of set out the argument for clean coal technology.
Sure. Just a word about the Clean Air Task Force. You know, we're a national environmental group. We're headquartered in Boston. I live in Illinois. And we work throughout the United States and increasingly in China and India. We don't take any money from private industry. We don't take any money from government. We're funded entirely by private foundations and individuals. So we don't, you know, have a vested interest in coal. What our interest is in climate and protecting the planet from CO2 emissions, as well as from particulates that are responsible for premature deaths and asthma and things like that. And I just would say, when it comes to coal, the fact is coal's dirty, but the reality is that coal use is going to double worldwide over the next couple of decades, particularly with the rate of increase of coal use in China and India and in the developed world. And if we don't clean up coal, it's really game over for climate change. The climate is, as we know it, as our grandparents have known it, as our parents have known it, won't exist for our great-grandchildren. And that's something that all of us who are concerned about the environment, you know, need to address.
Now, Brad Huebner, I mean, you have said earlier that you work with the Clean Air Task Force. When we were in the green room, you were talking a bit about that this is an organization that you know well, that you have some alliances with. But on the question of clean coal, that you part ways.
That's right. We're looking at this in different ways. And, you know, I understand where they're coming from. It's a huge challenge. We still get half of our power in America from coal, and the amount of coal use is rising internationally. And we have a climate crisis that has to be dealt with quickly. But I don't think that – so you sort of look at cleaning up coal as a potential a big hit solution. You know, what are the couple of things we can do to really get a long ways towards dealing with carbon dioxide emissions and global warming? Well, this just looks like one of those big solutions where you can have a few major operations to pump a lot of carbon dioxide in the ground, and with that amount of work, take a big step towards dealing with global warming. But the biggest problem is that it is so, first off, unproven, but then also, even if the engineers are right about what they think they can do, it's so enormously expensive that you could that money would be better spent elsewhere. And for a long-term solution, certainly in the United States and even in India and China, we should be investing in real solutions, using less power to meet our daily needs, and getting that power from clean sources. And there are plenty of examples of ways to do that.
But I want to set up for our listeners here. John, maybe you should be doing this. And I want to, if you could set up for us the discussion of theoretically, or even practically as you see it in places like India and other places where plants are being built, to make coal clean, what sequestering is, the different ideas about how this works, why the government is pumping $3.4 billion of stimulus money into clean coal and not into solar and not into wind and not into alternative renewable technologies. So talk for a minute and explain to our listeners, if you could, the theory behind clean coal. And then I want Brad to kind of go at it as well.
Sure. Let me just say at the outset, we're going to need all the technologies we can get to solve climate change. That means all the wind we can get, all the energy conservation we can get. And we're going to need carbon capture and storage. And let me define what that is for your listeners. You know, carbon dioxide, when it comes out of a power plant, when it comes out of your emission, your tailpipe from your car, it comes out at atmospheric pressure. It's a gas. In order to store it deep underground, it has to be compressed to many, many times atmospheric pressure, to the point that it's a liquid-like substance. It has the properties of both a liquid and a gas. And at that point, it can be injected in a well, you know, a mile or more below ground, and where the CO2 can be trapped in the pore space between the rocks. So while it takes a lot of energy to compress that CO2 and to inject it, there's really no other way to avoid climate change unless there's a solution to coal. And that's because 33%, or more of the CO2 emissions worldwide come from coal and power plants,
mm-hmm.
and it's not going to go away. So the other thing about cost, though, that's important to keep in mind is that when you look at what needs to happen on CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, you've got to meet a certain target to avoid global warming. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which shared the Nobel Prize with Al Gore for studying global warming, concluded that if you don't use carbon capture and storage, you raise the cost worldwide of meeting that CO2 target by about 30%. That's trillions and trillions of dollars that would otherwise be spent on things that probably your listeners also agree are important priorities, things like education, health care, that simply won't be available. And I'm worried that the cost will be so high if we were to try and do this without carbon capture and storage that federal policymakers simply won't adopt the deep cuts that are needed by mid-century to avoid global warming. So it really boils down to sort of a practical question. You know, coal use is increasing at an enormous rate worldwide. Every week, China adds one new coal plant, puts it online every single week. In 2007, they put on more new coal plants than have been built in the entire history of Great Britain. It is a phenomenal change. And here in the United States, as you pointed out, half our electricity comes from coal. If we don't solve the coal problem and we don't put on carbon capture and storage, we really have no way of averting the kinds of things that on climate change that are so critical.
So Brad, I mean, it's really is confusing when people hear this, because, I mean, everywhere you go, we just drove down to West Virginia back to visit my sister a few weeks ago, and everywhere you drive, Pennsylvania and other places, there are huge billboards that are saying that if we stopped using energy from coal, your lights would be out. And that the reality is, that is what that pumps the electricity through the veins of our cities and homes. So, and it's there. It's here. It's in the ground. It belongs to America.
Well, yeah, we can't turn off the coal plants overnight, and that's really the point. You can't clean up the coal plants overnight either. It would take decades to set up the infrastructure to really capture this carbon in any significant amount and make coal clean, not to mention the billions of dollars. It is much more expensive than other alternatives. It also takes a lot of time. So here in the U.S., first off, just getting off the ground, we've been trying for years to build one of these plants, right? And now we're talking about building hundreds of them around the world. That's going to take a long time. And then if it's to have the amount of impact that we need from one of the major solutions to global warming, you know, we need like 10 different things each to do their part to reduce global warming pollution, to really reach stability. You know, if you've seen the different wedge charts, we need a lot of different wedges to reduce our global warming pollution. If this were one of them, a significant wedge, we would need to pump CO2 into the ground about the same rate as we're currently pumping oil out of the ground. Now, just think about that. I mean, think of all the oil pumps, oil rigs, the infrastructure pumping oil out of the ground, and you're going to build that much stuff to pump CO2 back in the ground. How long is that going to take?
Is my CO2 we're using to refine the coal, so we can use it for fuel? That CO2 now goes into the atmosphere. The theory being that if you sequester it and build new technology, that the carbon dioxide that's polluting the world, instead of polluting the world, be put into the earth for how long? For what, we don't know, but will be put into the earth.
That's the theory, that you bury it in the earth and it'll stay there forever or for 100 years.
Well, it's not just a theory.
John Thompson.
It is being done. And let me just be clear, the alternatives aren't there.
What do you mean the alternatives are not there?
The scale problem that Brett has described is a problem that all technologies are going to face, whether it's wind, whether it's energy efficiency, whether it's nuclear. You know, pick your favorite technology.
Mm-hmm.
But the advantage of carbon capture and storage is that it's scalable. We have probably thousands of years hundreds to thousands of years of capacity in the United States to store the CO2. We have a history of building pipelines that can transport fluids, let's say natural gas in the 50s or CO2 in the coming decades. This is a solution that has to happen. And let me just, you know, take a step back and you know, explain why. You know, carbon dioxide is a fundamentally different pollutant than most of the pollutants associated or that people traditionally think of when they think of coal. You know, there's sulfur dioxide pollution, there's nitrogen oxide pollution. Both of those coal pollutants are linked to premature death and disease in the United States at significant levels.
And also particulate matter that ends up in your lungs that pollutes the cities of this country.
Precisely. CO2, those pollutants leave the atmosphere in days or weeks. CO2 does not. It stays in the atmosphere for hundreds of years, thousands of years. And we have already enough CO2 emitted over recent history to that there's already at least a degree or two of warming already, you know, put into the pipeline of warming in the atmosphere. And what's important about that is that everything the environmental movement has tried to achieve over the last 100 years is at risk from global warming. If all the species we've set aside or that we've tried to protect through endangered species laws, all the sensitive habitats we've tried to protect by buying them, all are at risk with a few degrees of temperature change because the ecosystems that support them would change and lead to, you know, situations that just can't be sustained. So we've got to get deep, deep carbon reductions by mid-century. And carbon capture and storage is not only important for coal, it's important for natural gas, it's important for oil. It's important for all the fossil fuels, because by mid-century, we're essentially going to have to operate this economy in the United States without CO2 from natural gas, CO2 from coal, and CO2 from oil. And the only way to do that is with carbon capture and storage.
Well, so John Thompson is director of the Coal Transition Project at the Clean Air Task Force, and not the former coach at Georgetown University. And but just to let you know before you get excited, and you can join us here at 410-319-8888. We're joined in studio by Brad Huebner, State Director of Environment Maryland. America is wrestling with the question of what to do about our energy future. We argued the other week, our first argument around nuclear power. Today we're looking at coal. Can it really be clean? And that's the argument we have today. We're going to look at these things more over the course of this next year. This is just our opening discussion to lay the groundwork because it's critical to where we're going to go. And so the question, Brad, I want you to respond to John. Our listeners, by the way, join us at 410-319-8888. How should we relate to our energy future? What do you think about clean coal as opposed to renewables? Is that the way we should go? Many of you may have family in that industry. What are your thoughts? We want to hear it. 410-319-8888. Now, Brad, two things. Before you jump into disagreeing with some of the things that John said, there's one thing he said that came up the other week when we looked at nuclear power, and it comes up again this week, that no matter what we do in America, whether it's coal sequestration, whether it's building new nuclear plants, that it's going to cost billions, or whether it's renewables or solar, or any other kind of renewable energy we can think of, it's going to cost billions of dollars for the technology and the infrastructure, and that the infrastructure already exists for coal. We know how to move liquid around. We don't know how to move the rest around yet. We have to rebuild the grid, which is going to cost up to $1 trillion. So that's some of the arguments being made. So talk about the cost argument that can be thrown back at renewables as well, and then take on what you want to take on about what John Thompson has said.
Well, the infrastructure does not exist to strip carbon dioxide out of the smokestacks from coal plants and to bury it underground. So that's a huge new thing that's extremely expensive and untested. This argument all seems to be based on the one idea that, as John said a minute ago, the alternatives are not ready to scale. You can't, as much as we would rather do other things rather than trying to bury the CO2 underground, we can't do them in big enough projects to really matter at the current time. Well, that's true of clean coal. That is, clean coal is not ready to scale at all, and it won't be for at least 15 years. Okay, so first off, half of that is true and half is not true. The thing that is ready to scale is energy efficiency. And we can reduce the amount of energy we use dramatically through upgrading our buildings and upgrading our equipment and machinery to use less natural gas and less electricity. That's number one. And it's cheaper. It boosts the economy. It's better for the economy to do that than not to do it. It's going to create jobs. It's going to save homeowners and small businesses money by reducing their utility bills. So that's just the obvious. That's half the equation. We know how to do it. The economics are great. We just need to go out and do it. We can do it here. We can do it in China. The other half is, okay, the generation. You know, we still, even if you're cutting your usage way down, you still need to generate a lot of power, right? And so what can we do 10 years from now? What can we get to scale 10 to 15 years from now? That's the question. Clean coal is one option. Well, there are other options, and they are quite viable. You know, wind power is one. Small-scale production in combined heat and power, small electricity generator, natural gas power generators that are super efficient can proliferate all over the place. The tricky thing is there, it just sounds a lot more complicated, doesn't it, to build thousands of mini generators rather than a few gigantic ones, right? It is. But it's very viable. The technology is there. It's tested. The economics are reasonable and will get better as it gets to scale. That can be done. And then even solar, when you're talking about 15 years from now, the cost is competitive, and you can see how it will get in big enough numbers of generation to really make a difference.
Well, so I want to come back to what you were just talking about, because they're talking about what will do our nation the best by and where we invest the money and what can really help our energy future. But the question is, it's the same thing as when we talk about health insurance and what happens to the insurance industry if U.S. went to single payer, let's say, for argument's sake, right? The argument is then you're laying off a couple of million, maybe up to a couple million people. I've seen estimates from 500,000 to a couple of million workers in that industry. So what happens? Coal is the backbone of the industry in states like Montana, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, numerous other places. And then the connected industries employ a lot of people, besides being half of our energy at the moment. So Brad and then Tom.
One thing we absolutely have to have is a just transition for the communities that have their economies based on coal right now. There are a lot of jobs there. There's the vitality of a lot of communities that's at stake. And you hear from communities like that with very compelling stories. You know, we've got nothing else here. So what we do need to do is to invest in those communities and make sure that some of the new clean energy economy, some of that activity happens in those communities. And we can do that through locating research centers and processing centers. There's so much infrastructure just in terms of the processing of all this that we can, like we take phone calls in India. You know, you can cite a lot of the management and the oversight and the processing in addition to the actual upgrades and research in those communities. We just need to make that a priority to put that in those places.
You know, a couple,
John Thompson,
couple points.
Please, sure. Go ahead.
Brad paints an attractive picture in terms of energy conservation. We need all of it that we can get. But here's the basic rub, is that to do what he's saying, all the coal has to disappear. And I'm unwilling to bet the planet that that's going to happen over any kind of meaningful time frame.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean all the coal has to disappear for what Brad says to work?
Because what he's saying is that we can do it without coal. We can do it with renewables. We can do it with energy efficiency. And that we don't need to invest in carbon capture and storage and clean coal. And that's just not going to happen. Because the problem is, by the time we find that it is impossible to do that, global warming will be irreversible, and the ecosystems that we all want to protect, the environment that we all want to protect, it is going to be irrevocably changed. That's the problem. And we have to get real. We've got to get pragmatic about this. And we need to invest in all the renewables we can. We need to invest in all the energy efficiency we can. But if we don't invest in cleaning up coal, it's game over on climate change.
And Brett?
I don't know how we jump to the conclusion there that it's not possible. It is. It's being proven over and over, and these technologies are viable. The cost is becoming reasonable, and as soon as you get to scale, it will be entirely affordable in comparison.
There's no major credible scientific study that excludes carbon capture and storage and suggests that we can do it without cleaning up coal, whether that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, whether it's other international studies. We've got to stop kidding ourselves about what the true danger that climate change poses and the reality of the tough choices we're going to have to make. And clean coal technology, it's a hot button issue.
Mm-hmm.
There are ads that if you look at on television from the Reality campaign that says clean coal is a myth. On the other end of the spectrum is industry ads that say clean coal has been with us for 30 years. The truth is in the middle. Coal is dirty, but the technology to clean it up does exist, and it needs to be deployed. And we don't deploy it now largely because it's cheaper to vent the CO2 into the atmosphere than it is to store it underground. That's got to change with climate bills, with cap and trade, but it's also got to change with incentives. And the reality is that clean coal technology is being deployed. There's what we would call NowGens. Maybe some of your listeners are familiar with the Future Gen project that the Bush administration proposed and then abandoned that would capture about 90% of the CO2 from a coal plant either be located in Texas or in Illinois.
Yeah.
NowGens are a different breed. These are commercial technology that's available now, maybe lower levels of capture, maybe 20%, maybe 60%, serious levels. There's probably about 20 of those projects that are in advanced development right now. Some have broken ground. Most won't unless the economic situation changes. They would capture, in some cases, turning coal into natural gas and capturing the CO2 from the gasification plant and storing it underground. These projects create jobs. We estimate that there's probably 9 to 13 of those that could break ground in the next 2 years and generate somewhere between 60 and 90,000 jobs.
Well, Brad, I meant to ask you, just before we go to break, I want to have a chance to kind of respond a bit here. I mean, what John is laying out, I think, for listeners is a fairly logical and pragmatic steps to how to get to a place that America needs to get to.
Well, nowhere is this happening, in contrast to what was just said. In Maryland, we have a clean coal plant. It's called Warrior Run. It's out near Cumberland. It's pretty small as far as coal plants go, but it's a serious plant. It costs an enormous amount of money to build, and it's much cleaner in terms of soot and smog-forming pollutants. And then they brag about the fact that they capture some of the CO2 from the emissions, and they actually use it to make soda and beer. They sell it to bottlers to carbonate beverages. But then you hear them talk proudly about how they're capturing CO2, and then you raise your hand and ask them, how much of the CO2 are you actually capturing? The answer is 3%. After a lot of work that was done there, they're barely scratching the surface. So these 40 and 60% figures, engineers are saying that they think they can do it if we throw billions of dollars at them, but that's completely unproven.
Well, so if we are in a world, and it seems to me from everything I've been reading, that clean coal technology will cost a great deal of money, that what you just said, Brad, is that it's that mark of 40, 60% is largely unproven as a theoretical model that people want to invest money in to make happen. But then our people also will argue that the same theoretical model exists for what we call renewables in this culture, that nobody really has their hands around what can work. And the fact that coal is, A, politically very powerful in America, that it employs so many people and is already here, has a strong argument in its favor that if we can create this clean technology, then that's where we should be spending the billions, as opposed to the billions on places we're not sure how we will transfer the energy from solar and wind to the rest of the country. So, I mean, the question really is, it seems to me here we're debating, is there are limited dollars to invest. We can't invest $1 trillion over the next 20 years in each technology. It's just impossible, it seems to me. So America has to pick its battle. So when we come back from this break, I want to figure out where that battle is and how we make that decision for our country. And we want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. We have some emails we're going to read when we came back that wrote to us at steinershow@gmail.com. But join us here at 410-319-8888 as we're joined by Brad Huebner and John Thompson to debate, is there such a thing as clean coal? Is it where America's future should be? It's your lungs. It's your energy future. You have to make that choice. We want you to join us. Reminding you now, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. For more information, go to MECU.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, reminding you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We are joined by Brad Huebner, State Director of Environment Maryland, and on the phone by John Thompson, who is Director of the Coal Transition Project at the Clean Air Task Force. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. What are your thoughts about the future of our energy in the United States of America? How will we get it? Many people argue clean coal is the way to go because it already produces coal, not clean coal, but coal produces 50% of the energy in America. It keeps the lights on. But is that the way for the future? Is clean coal technology possible? We've heard some of the arguments in the first half hour. We'll continue that now. And we want you to join us at 410-319-8888. I'll get these emails in just a minute. But first, Brad, let's pick up where we left off before we move into some other areas about coal and it being clean. And the question is, where do we put the money for America's future? Because right now, whether it's President Barack Obama or most of the members of the United States Congress or Congressman Ray Hall from West Virginia, who runs the Natural Resources Committee, and all the others who are in Congress, that clean coal, the notion of clean coal is where the power is.
Well, there's a real point there that there's political power from coal country. And one of the reasons the real reason why we might end up having to do some of this in national climate legislation is to buy off votes in the U.S. Senate from coal states. But I'm not going to sit here today and say that's why clean coal is good, right? Hopefully we don't even need to go there. But the question is, what's the alternative, and is that really, really viable? Let's look to California, that it was the first state to have a legislative mandate to say we're going to reduce our global warming pollution by X percent in this state. And by the way, let me add that Maryland, just yesterday, the last day of the legislative session, finalized an equivalent policy, which I worked very hard on, and we are now committed to reducing global warming pollution in Maryland 25% by 2020. One of seven, there are now seven states, we're the seventh one, to say that we're going to do this. And this puts us on the path towards avoiding, you know, what scientists say, here's what you need to do to avoid the worst impacts of global warming. So we're going to do it. But California is further along. They passed this several years ago. And they have done extensive studies as to different strategies to get there. Clean coal was certainly part of that study. And their analysis showed that they would have to pay 17 cents per kilowatt hour in order to make that happen. Currently in Maryland, we're paying about 11 or 12 cents per kilowatt hour retail price. You used to be able to generate electricity from coal at 4 cents or 3 cents a kilowatt hour. Now it might be 5. Wind and natural gas are now about 11 cents per kilowatt hour. So clean coal, even, you know, years into the future, as their analysis through 2020 showed, 17 cents per kilowatt. It's one of the more expensive options. They're not going to do it. What they are going to do is solar, believe it or not. Solar and the state of California and the utilities out there that have to meet this requirement and the California Public Utility Commission and Cal EPA that are overseeing this program. And the Southern California Edison just signed a deal, a long-term 20-year contract of power from some solar thermal plants in the Mojave Desert. So not solar panels on top of rooftops, but solar concentrated to turn a turbine where it's really hot. And then, and we're talking about hundreds of megawatts. This is equivalent to, it's the size of a major, of several major coal-fired power plants.
So two questions for John Thompson. Let me just add.
They're also, I would point out, Southern Cal Edison, pursuing zero-emission plants that use coal and petroleum coke. And those are moving ahead as well. And it just underscores there's no one solution. Let me be clear about the challenge ahead of us. By mid-century, the United States is going to have to cut its CO2 emissions by 80%. To put that in some perspective, if you took all the CO2 that we emit today and you were to zero out all of the carbon from the electric sector, nothing from natural gas, nothing from coal, nothing from oil, zero out all the CO2 from transportation, nothing from buses, nothing from cars, nothing from planes, we would still not meet that 80% level of reduction. And over the next 50 years, the population is going to grow. It's fantasy to think we can do this without investing in carbon capture and storage. And I know it's easy to think about, to say, well, where are the plants? The reality is the plants are few in number, but they are being developed. There's a plant proposed in Kentucky that is seeking an air permit that would capture 90% of its CO2 to make coal into natural gas and then burn it in an uncontrolled natural gas combined cycle plant. There are plants proposed in Texas that would capture 80 and 90% of their CO2. They are few and far between because they require the CO2 to be used for what's called enhanced oil recovery, injecting it into an old oil field to recover more oil. And there aren't a lot of those around. But really where carbon capture and storage is a lot where the aviation industry was 100 years ago. In 1905, the Wright brothers did the first powered flight at Kitty Hawk, and I think people would have laughed at the idea of an aviation industry 20 years later. And yet by 1925, we had airmail moving about 14 million letters and packages a year in the United States. We had airplanes as a key part of the War Department, and about a few thousand people every year were taking commercial planes between cities. That's the challenge of scaling up carbon capture and storage that we face, and we've done it. And if we don't do it, it's game over for climate change. We can't protect the climate without carbon capture and storage.
Now, Brad, you know, John Thompson has said a number of times in this program so far, game over for climate change if we don't use a huge portion of this money to create clean coal technology. I think, and then John, I think, John, you probably would agree at this moment that that technology is not, does not exist yet.
No.
We're still working on it.
I wouldn't say that it doesn't exist. What it doesn't exist is on the scale needed to solve the problem. And that's different than, you know, being technically available.
Okay.
But
so,
it's not going to be deployed until we have serious climate legislation in the United States.
Well, let me, Brad, would you agree that the technology exists, it just has to be perfected?
Well, it exists in the laboratory at Oak Ridge National Laboratory or something like that. It doesn't exist in the real world.
It does. It, you know, the Dakota gasification plant captures 3 million tons a year of CO2, sends it by pipeline for enhanced oil recovery into Canada. There are oil refineries in Europe that gasify and separate CO2 using gasification technology that could easily be used for coal.
Well, let me let Brad kind of respond to you for a minute, please, Brad.
Yeah, but they're not operating at the level where we need them to. And so how do you get from here to there? And clean coal is one option. There's no question that this is one option. But we would be doing it at the expense of a lot of other options, and why cut those back when they are better in the end, and invest in the, I mean, the politically powerful people is the only reason to do that. But another thing we just did in the Maryland General Assembly session this year was approve a technology for micro generators. It can be put in people's homes. Combined heat and power, so it both heats your home and provides your electricity. Fueled by natural gas, super efficient. You know, it's more efficient than your average, you know, big scale power plant. Plus, it heats your home, and it's very cost effective. As long as the power that you put back on the grid, you get paid for, which is what we created a law to say you could do that. And so this technology exists. So but it seems a little harder to put one of these in every home. And the engineers certainly don't like it as well, to do this little thing in everybody's home rather than doing these gigantic projects that feel great and it feels like you're solving the problem. They're big projects. We all get together and the engineers love them. But the fact is these other technologies exist and we shouldn't be doing the mega projects at their expense.
Well, let's look at some numbers. In Maryland, about 60% of your energy comes from electricity comes from coal. Another 29% from nuclear. Another 6% or so from natural gas. We need to get as much renewables as we can, and I'm glad that Maryland has a portfolio standard that's going to move renewables to 20% from around 1% right now to 20% in 2020, or 2022. But you know what? What are we going to do with the other 80%? It's that 80% that's going to kill us. And if we don't get carbon capture and storage moving at scale, it's really game over on climate change. And the technology, the basic problem with all of these technologies is one of storage. With wind, the storage problem is that it, often blows at night when you don't need the electricity, and it's not available during the day when you do. And if we can solve that storage problem, wind is going to do a lot better. The problem on storage with nuclear is the waste. Can we keep it isolated for the thousands of years that it could pose a danger to humans, or keep it out of the hands of terrorists? And with fossil fuels, the storage problem is CO2 storage deep underground. All of those climate challenges involve storage, and we've got to solve all of them. It's not picking one or the other. We're going to need all the renewables we can. We're going to need all the energy efficiency we can.
So let me, just because we only have a little bit of time left, I want to get to another subject with this, and I have this email that came in, these emails that came in. But so Brad Heavener, I mean, are you arguing that renewable sources, wind, solar, wave energy, all the things that people are talking about that exist, that you could generate electricity and other energy with in America, are viable enough to, along with what you're talking about, energy efficiency in America, to supply all the energy needs in the United States of America
eventually,
in the next 20 years?
Eventually, obviously, we have to. The question is when. And then how do you get on course to get there, right? The most important factor in dealing with global warming is acting quickly, getting on pace to deal with the problem, right? The things we do now are way more important than the things we do 20 years from now. So the 20% renewable energy by 2022 that we're committed to here in Maryland, ideally we exceed that. That's the minimum standard we have. That does put us on course toward meeting greater reductions elsewhere. It's enough. There's a good picture. I mean, we've got plenty of research showing here are the exact things you can do. Menu of options, clean options here in Maryland to get on course to reduce our global warming pollution enough. And one other example I'd point to is offshore wind. Wind, it's ready. It's there. It works. And yes, it would work better if you could store the power. But even if you can't, it still works pretty well. There's a company that wants to build an offshore wind park offshore from Ocean City, 12 miles into the ocean. And 600 megawatts of wind turbine. And so the wind's not always blowing. You can only count on about a third of that power, but it's still half as big as a major power plant. So clean coal would happen at the expense of a project like that.
But talk about clean coal this hour, and the argument has been whether that technology exists, whether that's an oxymoron. John Thompson, director of Coal Transition Project at Clean Air Task Force, says no, this is the way we have to go if we're going to survive in America. And Brad Heavener would say yes, and he's state director for Environment Maryland. 410-319-8888. I want to read this email. And I also want to talk about the other end of this question of clean. And we have to come back and really kind of look more on this, on the technology. Bob writes in from Johns Hopkins University, what does John Thompson think about coal gasification and liquefaction to make diesel fuel?
Two different technologies. Gasification is a lot cleaner. But when it comes to doing, coal to liquids, here's the rub. You can capture the CO2 from coal to liquids on gasification, and you can get the footprint of that resulting diesel fuel to be about the same as existing diesel fuel or a little bit more. But where we're going to have to be by 2050 is zeroing out all of that, you know, on the transportation side, if we're going to get 80% reduction. So I think the role for gasification is maybe not so much on diesel, but making substitute natural gas or methane, because what the steps that are likely for clean coal are really a couple things. One, we've got to do things like ban mountaintop removal. That's where you, in Appalachia, where you basically blow up a mountain to get to the coal and fill in the valleys with the residue. We've got to use technologies like coal gasification that can really drop sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, and mercury by an order or two of magnitude lower than conventional technology. And we've got to use carbon capture and storage, and we've got to use it not just for coal. We've got to use it for natural gas. We've got to use it for oil. And we've got to scale that up over the next 30, 40 years. It is not a choice between do you do renewables or do you do clean coal. We're going to have to do them both.
And Brad, let me bring you back into this. So I want you to, if you have an argument to counter the camera, because you did, John, I was about to ask you about the billions of tens of billions of gallons of toxic coal sludge that exists throughout Appalachia that has destroyed many communities already.
It's absolutely terrible.
And millions of tons, hundreds of millions of tons of coal ash every year. Somebody wrote enough to fill a train of boxcars stretching from Washington to Australia. And that nobody regulates that but the 600 landfills, but state governments would do a lousy job at it. So
they do a terrible job at it.
So Brad, you and John, I'm sure, on the same page on this. So give us your argument about what John was saying from the other side then.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can do a better job with that, and we absolutely have to. Right here in Maryland, we have a very real example down in Anne Arundel County where there was a coal ash landfill that was poorly designed, leaked in like toxic ash into the local drinking water. Residents nearby were drinking arsenic and beryllium and thallium at levels above the safe levels, toxic water from they're drinking out of their taps. Constellation Energy just settled a lawsuit with some of them for $54 million. Obviously a very big problem, right? So could we do better? And then to look at Tennessee, right? We heard about that last December, 1 billion gallons of toxic sludge spread over 300 acres. You know, that is bad. So can we do better? I'll bet we can, you know, if we spend the money. If we spend the money, we can design better landfills. We can stop putting them in these gigantic holding ponds. But then it becomes even more expensive to use coal.
So let me ask you this question, Brad. I want to get this clear because I've been reading and talking to lots of people. Most people in the environmental movement are saying that clean coal technology is more myth than reality and that it can't happen. But I'm hearing you say, you know, I'm not hearing you say that. I'm hearing you say, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I want you to explain yourself here, that you're saying that the technology may exist to create this, but you're arguing that's not where the money should go.
Yeah. We've shown that we can put strip off 3%, probably 10% of the carbon dioxide from the emissions. I'm sure we could figure out how to pump it underground, and I'm sure it's going to stay there for 50 years, right? Maybe 100, maybe more, but who knows? Nobody knows right now. That could provide a transition as we get over the hump and really and get stabilized CO2 in the atmosphere. Certainly we can do that much. Now, would it perform better than that? Maybe. But then even to get to that level, you're talking about an enormous amount of money, and that money would be much better spent elsewhere. That's the bottom line. And there are other viable alternatives.
Well, the bottom line is that if you exclude carbon capture and storage, take whatever electric bill or price for renewables and Brad's solution and add 30%, because that's what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which shared the Nobel Prize with Al Gore, said. The cost of complying with climate stabilization targets is if you exclude carbon capture and storage. We can't afford not to do this technology.
Well, and very quickly, I'm going to let you come right back. I want Brad to respond to that because I want to get to some points before we run out of time. Brad.
Well, and then Jim Hansen from NASA is probably the most respected climate scientist in America. Wonderful, wonderful man, brilliant man, has said over and over, look, I hate to repeat this, but it's hard to imagine not burning all the oil in the world eventually. You know, how do you get Saudi Arabia not to pump the oil and sell it, right? That's going to be really hard. But coal is a different question, and we're just not going to deal with the climate crisis if we don't leave some of that coal in the ground.
Now, let me throw this out to both of you, and I was reading one of the many pro-arguments, one of the opposing arguments came from Greenpeace I was reading this afternoon, that argued that the energy required to capture the carbon, pressure it, pump it underground is much too large, and the risks of underground storage, as they saw in some explosions that weren't for storage, but from other CO2 buildup in the ground, like I think it was Gabon, blew up, and that the risks are too high, and that this actually diverts money from places where we should be developing it, which is solar, wind, and other alternative energies. Let me ask John very quickly to respond to that, and then Brad responds as well.
Sure, I don't agree. I think that carbon capture and storage, not every site is suited for it, but I think that many sites are. And if you look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they say that a properly sited carbon capture and storage location is going to have a greater than 99% chance of keeping that CO2 below ground for 1,000 years. That's the kind of change we need if we're going to solve climate.
And we're going to set up an inspection system worldwide to make sure that this happens efficiently in Gabon, in India, and elsewhere, right? That's a little leap of faith for me. The fact that this engineer's dream that's enormously expensive can have some impact, sure. But is it going to perform as well as the best hopes, the unproven hopes are? No. And accidents will happen. Of course accidents are going to happen. Of course failures are going to happen. That's just part of it. So do we want to invest? You know, we have a choice. We're at a turning point where we're realizing that this is an enormous problem and that we have to take big action. It's a great moment in America, really, that we're realizing that this is a huge problem and where the political will is really building to deal with it. We're going to pass a climate bill in Congress. You know, that's huge. Some kind of bill. Right?
China.
That
India.
In itself is huge. Okay, so we're at this critical juncture, and are we going to choose to invest all of this money in an unproven engineer's dream, or are we going to expand the existing proven technologies and get them to scale that are truly clean?
John, go ahead.
Carbon capture and storage is proven, and it's unwise and unrealistic to bet the planet that coal is going to disappear in the coming decades. And China and India are modernizing. Their energy consumption is rising. And if we continue to store that CO2 in the atmosphere, we will have glacial melting. We will have temperature rise. We will have irreversible ecological damage. It is foolish to say we can do this without carbon capture and storage. There are no credible scientists that believe that, you know, or studies that suggest we can actually do this without carbon capture and storage.
At the end of the day,
we have to do all the renewables we can, all the energy conservation we can, and all the other kind of technologies like carbon capture and storage, because if we don't, the world as we know it won't exist.
So, and Brad, I want you, one of the key points in this discussion we're having is John Thompson saying that without sequestering coal to create the energy to sequester the CO2, I'm trying to say, that it is impossible to think about a clean energy future. Renewables can't do it alone. And your response is?
I think we need a little more vision than that. I would like to help China modernize. Yes, they're modernized. I want to help them. I want to teach them how to build hybrid cars. I want to teach them how to build micro generators. I want to teach them how to use a caulk gun, for crying out loud. I want to teach them how to do all these things that will improve their energy picture in really positive ways. That's possible. Yeah, I lived in China for 2 years. I know something about its economy and its culture, and I think that there's opportunity there. I think there's huge opportunity there. It is a huge risk. I mean, the coal plant a week is frightening. But we can teach them to do the right thing rather than the Band-Aid thing.
The reality is that China, in the last year, built more new coal plants than in the history of Great Britain. Those plants have a 50-year life. If we don't put carbon capture and storage on them, we'll simply end up with climate change because they're not going to bulldoze those new plants and replace them with whatever technology Brad thinks would be nicer.
And Brad, you have 30 seconds here.
Well, there's a clear picture of how in America we can reduce our emissions on pace to what scientists tell us we have to. And it will boost our economy. It's good for us economically. And it's very feasible. We know the technology. We can roll it out. And we can then turn around and sell that to the rest of the world. That's where I want Congress to be investing my taxpayer dollars.
Every Tuesday at this time at 5 o'clock, we are going to be debating and discussing our sustainable future. And we'll come back to the subject. John Thompson, we want to have you back, Director of the Coal Transition Project at Clean Air Task Force. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Brad Heavener, State Director of Environment Maryland. Good to have you here as well. And thank you to the Town Creek Foundation for making this series possible. The Mark Steiner Show is also made possible by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This April, Urbanite shows its colors with a green issue, offering a comprehensive guide to eco-friendly living and taking a close look at the area's green economy. Available in print at 800 locations and at urbanitebaltimore.com. Right after the top of the hour, Steve Janis and Glenn Ford join us from Online Papers to talk about the future of online in the face of disintegrating newspapers in this country. What do you think? Stay with us. We'll be right back.